Your Honors, please. The judicial branch of government has a responsibility. The tens of thousands, indeed millions of people who reside in this country know the truth and look to this court. Believe me, I think this is the last place we have to look, to this court for justice. And I hope that the Michigan Supreme Court has the strength, the character, and the integrity to finally, after 27 long months, give us that which we've asked for. Thanks very much.
Calling case number 20, Carter versus calling case number 19, People v. John Sinclair.
May it please the court. My name is Justin Ravitz. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant in this cause, John Sinclair. I only have, as I understand it, 1/2 an hour, and I'd like the court to know that I'm going to assume that your honors have carefully studied the briefs and the appendix submitted in this cause, and I'm going to address myself as much as possible to matters that are outside the context or the direct context of the brief as it's been submitted. I'd like to point out to the court that I wish to reserve somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll try to allocate my time in such a manner as to allow me to do so. It seems to me that we might begin analysis with this case with, one, the state of the record with respect to that.
Mr. Ravitz, before you start in, I might say to you that while you are limited to 30 minutes, we won't be holding you real closely to that if you actually need some additional time. It is the allotted time for presentation. We hope that you can keep within it, but if you're not able to, we will give you some time.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'd like to start, if the court please, with pointing out to the court that which was submitted to the trial court originally when the trial court was asked to make fact findings in this cause. And significantly, as I'm sure Your Honors recognize, the record below consists of only two matters submitted by the prosecution. One was that list, to which I shall address myself later, of violent crimes supposedly connected with the use of marijuana, submitted by a certain person by the name of James Munch. The other was a letter by a person named Maurice Sievers, who we later uncover in the prosecution's brief to this court, is a doctor who was quoted in a book by Dr. Edward Bloomquist. Interestingly, it seems to me, in the letter submitted by the prosecution in support of their case, Dr. Sievers says, and I quote, "I am in favor of modification of our currently unrealistic law as concerning possession," close quote. I'd like to point out to this court a number of other quotes, most of which are cited in our brief in this cause or in the brief in the cause of People versus Lorenzen, which is also pending before this court. The Director of Commissions for the State of Michigan, Gus Harrison, has been quoted as saying, and I quote, "Strictly from a correction standpoint, if a fellow who uses marijuana comes to prison, there isn't a great deal we can do for him. He probably doesn't need anything. I doubt very seriously that most marijuana offenders are dangerous. And to make them eligible for sentences, as long as we find on the books right now, for those who deal with drugs, I think is doing everybody a lot of harm. I don't see any sense in making criminals out of people who aren't." The prosecutor for Wayne County, the chief law enforcement officer in that county, has been quoted as saying, and this is from March 1968, Detroit Free Press, and it too appears in our brief, quote, "It's almost humanly impossible to effectively enforce the marijuana law because there is a vast majority or vast number, I don't know whether it's a majority, but a vast percentage who are not in accord with our marijuana law." The Attorney General for the State of Michigan is quoted in the Ann Arbor News, September 26 of this year, saying, "The time has come for us to consider the possibility of decriminalizing certain unlawful activities for which there are no innocent victims." He continues, Marijuana use accounts for another very large portion of arrests throughout the nation. Surely the use of marijuana should receive much more attention as a public health problem than as a criminal problem. Criminal investigations should concentrate on the sale and distribution of marijuana and of narcotics. Just dealing with these problems of drunkenness and marijuana use in a constructive way would free tremendous resources of manpower, funds, and facilities for concentration on the crimes of greatest concern to the people of our state and of the nation. We have there Dr. Seavers, Gus Harrison, William Cahalan, Frank Kelly. We have further Judge Johnson in his lower court opinion from the Court of Appeals in this case, a prior prosecutor, of course, of Oakland County, as this court well knows. We have, at the same time, maintained continuously throughout this case, without contradiction, that there's only one person in prison or ever placed in prison in the history of this state for possession of marijuana, let alone for possession of only two cigarettes of marijuana for a term of 9.5 to 10 years. Indeed, we've alleged without contradiction, and frankly, we don't know, we do not have the full records, but we've alleged that we've never heard of anyone serving such a sentence indeed for heroin. And I would point out to the court that in Monroe County, people were arrested and charged with the unlawful possession, if you can imagine it, of 2,000 pounds of marijuana. And persons in that case are doing 2 to 5. They're not doing 9.5 to 10 years. Now these create, it seems to me, questions for the judiciary. The anomaly of the law, of a law that locks up John Sinclair for 9.5 to 10 years for 2 cigarettes and that treats persons unlawfully possessing 2,000 pounds in the manner in which I've described. The anomaly of a law that treats marijuana under the harshest felony penalties imaginable and that simultaneously has, interestingly enough, in the suburban enclaves of this state, misdemeanor ordinance penalties in Grosse Pointe, Bloomfield Hills, Ann Arbor, and other such locales, that authorizes and enables the police and the prosecution to make a choice whether to treat a person as a most dangerous felon or to treat a person as a mere minor misdemeanor. These are all facts. Facts that exist, and facts that this court, it seems to me, has to take into account. At the same time, what do we receive from the prosecution? We receive a brief, and we're still put to the task of listening and of being patient to allegations such as that which appears in the prosecution's brief, where at page 23, they refer to a 2-year-old boy whose heart had been removed and a broken bottle inserted in the cavity from an alleged Dr. J.G. Fraser, whoever he is quoted in the Detroit Daily Press, November 27, 1967. And I would hope that this court would ask the prosecution, who has asked and indeed who has taken 9.5 to 10 years of my client's life from him, just exactly who J.G. Fraser is and just what the purpose of including that sort of language in a brief to this court is. Because you see, that's the source of the problem. The source of the problem is found, for example, in the letter or in the study submitted by a so-called doctor named James Munch, who lists a category of crimes in the prosecution's initial submission to the trial court. And that same James Munch testified before the Federal Congress in 1937. And that was the basis upon which this law was, of course, passed. But a number of things have happened. One, it has been proven, and I submit scientifically, that the initial origin of the marijuana legislation was that it was alleged to cause violent crime. And that is that allegation was really disproven, and disproven based upon fact and based upon empirical evidence. Then they came up with, despite the answer that Harry Anslinger, the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics and really the father of this law in this country, gave to Congressman Dingell. back at the time of the original hearings. Despite that answer that there was no tendency to go from marijuana to heroin, as we've quoted in our brief, in 1951, when the crime theory failed, they adopted and tried to rely upon, if you will, the stepping stone theory, that marijuana leads to the use of heroin. And this notwithstanding the fact that Dr. Stanley Yalas from the National Institute of Mental Health is quoted in a decision that I shall point out to the court shortly as saying that only 1% of the users of marijuana in this country have graduated to heroin. And yet that was the theory, and that was the basis for this law for another decade or more. And finally, that theory has also failed. And what does government then do? Government doesn't, at least not sufficiently quickly, at least not in, it seems to me, a fully honest way, abandon and change the law when there's no longer a basis for it. They keep trying to come up with new bases. And now we hear talk about a motivational syndrome, whatever that means. And I would point out to the court a couple of things. One, it seems to me that the book by Professor Kaplan, Marijuana, the New Prohibition, is a book that I would urge every member of this bench to read. And I would ask you also to consider the background and the credentials of Professor Kaplan, his background being a member of the U.S. Attorney's Office, his background as a scholar, as a teacher, and is certainly an impartial person who has studied this field. And in considering that, one should consider, it seems to me, also Judge Toro's opinion, which is appended to the prosecution's brief to this court. Because what Judge Toro's opinion points out, and what is also pointed out by Professor Kaplan, is that what has happened in this area of the law is that a certain segment of society, indeed that segment of society which has control of the body politic, that is the establishment, if you will, has determined that what they proclaim to be the vice of another culture or subculture within society is not to be tolerated. And what marijuana has taken on is a tremendous symbolic importance in terms of the divisions of a subculture and the persons who control the body politic, at least at the legislative level. And he points to that, and he also points, Professor Kaplan does, to the origins of prohibition and the origins whereby, for example, and he cites the major study that was ever done on the prohibition era, and that study is a book by Professor Joseph Gusfield entitled Symbolic Crusade. He points out how there were two vying, if you will, cultures, the rural white Protestant culture, who essentially was looking with disdain upon the urban Roman Catholic and somewhat self-righteously proclaiming that it was such a vice to be drinking and to be engaging in such habits, which is not to say, in point of fact, that drinking isn't a problem. This record is replete, it seems to me, and all scientific studies are replete, with the very serious harms and problems caused by alcohol. But nonetheless, this society was forced to conclude that government is not omnipotent, that the limitations of enforcing morality upon society in essentially a victimless crime doctrine of sumptuary legislation simply sometimes is not workable. And this court, it seems to me, has to consider that question as well. Now, I'd like to point out to the court, and I did not have an opportunity to duplicate the opinion, that I would mention to your honors that I would be happy to submit almost forthwith copies of the recent opinion in the Illinois case of People of the State of Illinois versus Thomas McCabe, a decision which was rendered in May of 1971, that must be when it was argued. I heard about the decision and just received it a few days ago. This, it seems to me, is a very, very significant case. It's a significant case because the court in Illinois adopts the precise equal protection analysis that was submitted before this court, indeed submitted before the trial court in this case, on the question of equal protection. And I would like to read just briefly, if I might, from that decision. I don't know if your honors have had an opportunity to see this case or not.
We do have some copies of the case, and but if you will submit the regular number of copies, we'll be appreciated.
I'll do so today from Detroit, Your Honor. I would just like to read very briefly, if I might, then from page 9. As the court is no doubt familiar, They made a very detailed comparative analysis of the scientific and medical facts concerning marijuana, concerning the amphetamines, the barbiturates, concerning heroin and cocaine as well. And having done so and having made their comparisons, the court concluded at page 9, and I read, quote, against the entire background of the drugs considered, we judge that the classification of marijuana under the Narcotics Drug Act, rather than under the Drug Abuse Control Act, has been arbitrary. A comparison of the drugs leads to a conclusion that marijuana more closely resembles drugs placed in the Drug Abuse Control Act. It is, comparatively speaking, dissimilar from drugs under the Narcotics Drugs Act. We do not find a rational basis for the classification, a consequence of which is that one first convicted of the sale of marijuana must, without qualification, receive a sentence 10 times greater than one permitted to be imposed on one convicted for the first time of a sale of drugs under the Drug Abuse Act. The absence of a rational basis for distinguishing first convictions for sales of marijuana from first convictions for sales of drugs placed in the Drug Abuse Control Act compels the conclusion that the present classification of marijuana offends the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. And they continue, close quote. I would point out to the court as well.
You would say are pertinent as far as classification goes.
The two Michigan statutes,
yes,
as far as classification.
Isn't that the basis of the Illinois decision?
That's correct, Your Honor. The two would be, one, the statute upon which my client was convicted, which carries a maximum sentence of 10 years, and he, of course, received 9.5 to 10, and the dangerous drug statute, which prohibits LSD, peyote, mescaline, psilocybin, and other such dangerous drugs. And according to the Illinois decision, as I read it, very clearly, that court would hold, and I should point out the LSD statute carries a maximum sentence of 4 years imprisonment for the sale as well as the unlawful possession of marijuana. In applying the Illinois decision, that court would have held that it was a violation of equal protection to include marijuana with heroin and cocaine in the opiates, and not to have included it with what it is more similar to with respect to the dangerous drugs. And that case can be directly applied to the state of law in Michigan. And I should point out further to the court a very important distinction between our case and the case of Commonwealth versus Lice, which of course was the famous Massachusetts decision of 1967 by Judge Toro, in which was appended to the prosecution's brief. Significantly, in the state of Massachusetts, the maximum penalty in that state was 3.5 years imprisonment. And I think even more significantly, their drug act, Your Honors, included all of the drugs together. In other words, LSD, peyote, mescaline, marijuana, cocaine, and heroin all fell under the umbrella of one classified drug statute, which is tremendously distinguishable, if you will, from the Illinois legislation and from the Michigan legislation as well. And that seems to me to be quite significant. I would point out to the court as well the decision in State versus Zorn, Z-O-R-N-E-S, from the state of Washington, cited in our brief at page 73, and also the decision in State versus Ward from New Jersey, cited in our brief at page 100. It seems to me that this court has abundant authority to go on grounds of equal protection based upon the Illinois decision, the state of Washington, and the state of New Jersey decisions. With respect to the issue of cruel and unusual punishment, it seems to me that this court is obliged indeed to decide one legal question, I would hope right away. I would hope that in this court's opinion, whatever it might be, this court would consider immediately the position taken by the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals and the position also taken by the prosecutor. As I read the Court of Appeals decision, they say that the judicial branch of government does not have the power to strike down as cruel and unusual any sentence that is within the confines of the penalty prescribed by the legislature. That's their position. The prosecutor's position is identical, and it goes further, and it says, in addition to that, that there's nothing unusual or cruel about simply a prison sentence, and that the cruel and unusual punishment provision was designed to, I guess, give the judicial branch of government power to stop torture and all sorts of barbaric punishments. Well, the truth of the matter is I think this court is certainly capable of recognizing that the case of Weems versus United States directly refutes the doctrine followed by the Court of Appeals and relied upon by the prosecutor. In that case, Mr. Weems was sentenced under a statute that carried a minimum mandatory sentence of 12 to 20 years, and he was sentenced to 15 years. Now, there were rather barbaric overtones to that sentence as well, chains and shackles and things like that. But the United States Supreme Court did not simply strike down those provisions relating to chains and shackles. To the contrary, the United States Supreme Court struck down the entire statute on its face as being cruel and unusual, and the theory was that the penalty was disproportionate to the nature of the offense. And that's precisely what we have here. That's precisely what I think a very fine Michigan Supreme Court in 1888 applied in the case of People versus Murray at 72 Michigan, referred to in our brief. And I might quote from that for just a second, if I may, Your Honors. And in the People versus Murray decision, the court said, and this is important in terms of understanding, it seems to me, the separation of powers, and also understanding a case cited by the prosecutor, which I will refer to. The court in Murray said, and this is cited in our brief, quote, we see nothing in this record warranting any such sentence, and it must be regarded as excessive. It will not do to say the executive may apply the remedy in such a case. We do not know what the executive may do, and it is but a poor commentary upon the judiciary when it becomes necessary for the executive branch to regulate the humanity of the bench. They go on, but the Constitution has not left the liberty of the citizen of any state entirely to the discretion or caprice of its judiciary, but enjoins upon all that unusual punishments shall not be inflicted. This one is unusual. This one is disproportionate to the nature of the offense, an offense made a misdemeanor in Grosse Pointe, if you will, very often. It's disproportionate to marijuana versus heroin. It's disproportionate to two marijuana cigarettes versus 2,000 pounds. How can this court not say it's disproportionate? I don't believe any honest man can. I don't believe anyone can. I'd like to point out to the
record of the defendant has something to do with a sentence imposed.
Certainly does, Your Honor. He has two prior marijuana convictions.
Does he have anything else?
He had, I believe, or does have, an assault and battery out of Oakland County as well. And I would compare that record. You know, I don't know how the court would undertake or how we would move to have a hearing on equal protection. It seems to me that that would be an open-ended hearing and that it would take forever to show how disproportionate this sentence is juxtaposed to other sentences. We've submitted it. We've said it time and again. We believe it to be true. We believe that this court has both the experience as well as the judicial capacity to notice that which is true is true. If this court ever wanted to remand for a hearing on equal protection, we would be delighted to do so. We would only ask the court that our client be permitted to be free on bond pending such a hearing. I'd point out to the court further that given the limitation in time, I cannot address myself to every issue. I've mentioned Professor Kaplan's book, and we of course have a rather lengthy section in our brief dealing with the right of due process and dealing with rights to privacy. It seems to me that if this court were to compare that section of the brief and to study the Kaplan brief as well, the Kaplan book as well, that this court couldn't help but conclude that what is against the public welfare, safety, and morality in the state of Michigan is, in fact, the marijuana law. That if this court were to exercise and take leadership in the battle of what is called crime on the streets, this court would understand, particularly through Professor Kaplan's study, the enormous cost of society in enforcing this ridiculous and unconstitutional law. This court would further consider that which is suggested by Professor Kaplan, and that is the regulation and the control through licensing of marijuana, which would, one, enable the state to control the quality of the drug, which would, two, free law enforcement of a tremendous, incalculable expense that is borne by the courts and by the police and the prosecutor's office throughout this state for prosecuting marijuana. And I'd refer the court, I did not bring it with me, to the, for example, 1970 Recorder's Court statistics as to the number of narcotics offenses. And I would represent to the court, and Your Honor should know it to be true, that the bulk of those prosecutions are in fact marijuana and not heroin. If in fact marijuana were to be licensed, then there could be a tax revenue. And that tax revenue could be applied to fight the real problems of crime in this society, to fight, if you will, among other things, the heroin problem, which we know to be associated with tremendous amounts of criminality. That, to my mind, is what a rational society would do. I would point out to the court, I should mention very quickly that James Shallow, a very eminent attorney from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, wrote a section of the brief dealing with the chemistry or the testimony of the expert witness. And I don't feel adequately qualified to discuss at length that issue with the court, but I think he did a masterful job in the brief, and I'd like to highlight it as well to your honors, because that's something that's gone on for years and years. Chemists come in, and they're really only technicians. They're not even subject to meaningful cross-examination, and they give the usual conclusory terms. On other issues, I would ask the court to look at Issue 9, which I'm calling the Luck Issue, and that refers to Judge Colombo's ruling that under any circumstances, if John Sinclair were to have testified at his trial, the court had no choice but to allow the prosecution to impeach him based upon his prior convictions. And I call it the Luck Issue because it comes from Luck versus United States from the District of Columbia Circuit. I would ask the court to read that issue in conjunction with issue number 8, which speaks to the way in which law enforcement isolated John Sinclair and set him up in a situation whereby he would be disallowed from having any other witnesses meaningfully testify on his behalf. And all that spelled out, it seems to me, in the facts of this case and in the 8th issue as it appears in our brief. On the one hand...
You have about 10 minutes left, so you can take it as you see fit.
Okay, I might take about 7 more minutes and then hope to be permitted to have some rebuttal time as well, Your Honor. Now, what happened, on the one hand, John Sinclair, with his reputation in the community, is by the delay of 33 days... of his arrest, is by their failure to record Vaughn Kapagian's alleged conversation with him, which would either prove or disprove its existence. By doing all these things, they isolated John Sinclair against the two law enforcement officers. And then they add to that and compound it, or not they, but then Judge Colombo, by his ruling, compounds it by saying, further, even though the only person you can put on to testify would be John Sinclair, we're going to point out that he has 2 prior marijuana convictions. And it matters not that they were 26 months old and 16 months old or something like that and attenuated. And what does that do as a practical matter? And I'm sure this court has the capacity of knowing what that does. What that does is that says that any unpopular person, that any person with prior marijuana convictions, or indeed a prior record perhaps, who can be so isolated, can be convicted throughout this state of a most serious felony, almost at the will of the police and the prosecution. But it happens that the law intercedes, and it happens that the law in the state of Michigan today, through the Michigan Court of Appeals in People versus Eldridge, cited in our brief, and in a not yet reported opinion, which I hope I'm at liberty to point out to this court, and that is People versus Farrar, F-A-R-R-A-R, which is docket number 10532 from the Michigan Court of Appeals, a decision just released, I think, within the last 2 weeks. The Michigan Court of Appeals has held that the Michigan statute, which was identical to the statute in D.C. at the time of the Luck decision, does not, in fact, compel the court to allow the prosecution at will to impeach one's prior credibility by prior convictions. That indeed the Michigan statute says the prosecution may do that. And the Michigan case law and the Luck rule imposes upon the court the obligation of exercising discretion in considering the probative value of such impeachment testimony versus the prejudicial value. Judge Colombo did not recognize that. Judge Colombo clearly violated such a rule because indeed he indicated on this record that his personal preference was to keep out such impeachment testimony, that he disagreed as a matter of principle with such a rule but felt compelled to let it in. It was wrong. And it was his obligation to exercise his discretion. And had indeed he exercised his discretion, John Sinclair could have testified. Now, two quick points under that that I'd like to make. One is the prosecution in footnote points out that the Luck rule no longer governs in the District of Columbia. That's true. I'd like to inform the court why. The reason isn't by case law saying it no longer governs. The reason is because the legislation in the District of Columbia has been changed in that may introduce prior conviction has overruled it. Secondly, the prosecution cites Carlton versus United States in their brief on the Luck issue. And that's a very tricky thing because what happens is in the Carlton issue, as the prosecution's brief reveals, what was at issue was entrapment. And the question properly formulated there was, can the prosecution introduce prior convictions where defense raises the issue and testifies to entrapment? And that's an entirely different ballgame, because that's a question of predisposition, wherein they might much more strongly argue the admissibility of prior convictions. But that didn't happen in our case. Judge Colombo ruled on a pretrial motion, regardless of what the defense might be, regardless of anything else, that he was absolutely obliged to permit such impeachment. And he erred. It seems to me that this court hopefully would address itself and follow the lead of the Michigan Court of Appeals in setting forward rational law. Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to conclude now. May I assume that I would be granted about 10 minutes in rebuttal?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much.
You know, and I represent the plaintiff appellee and the prosecuting attorney of Wayne County, Michigan. As I listened to Mr. Ravitz and the proof he wished to offer, I again have to reiterate that it would be better presented to the legislature. I think all of us cannot say that the 10-year max is harsh. There's no doubt about it. However, that particular max does not only embrace the young offender who is on a curious binge, but also the professional passer and seller, bailer, importer. And the discretion of the court can well fit the sentence to the crime. Now, I'm not going to justify the actions or the wisdoms of the legislature, including marijuana in our narcotic drug acts. Whether there should be a subparagraph or included in the same paragraph, as far as I'm concerned, is immaterial. The sentence reads from any number of days to 10 years for the first offense. And in this case, the law only sentenced the defendant for a first offender. We have a number of comparable statutes in every state in the country, including the federal government, which in 1970 the president signed into law the Comprehensive Drug Abuse and Prevention Act. That too has proscribed the possession of marijuana.
Is it customary to give 9.5 minimum on a first offense, Mr. Pendolino?
This, Your Honor, was not the first offense.
That's what you said it was. It was treated that way.
The prosecution could have, in this case, filed a supplemental information charging the defendant as a three-time habitual criminal if they wanted to, which, in my mind, would have been horrendous. But 9.5 to 10 years fell within the discretion of the trial judge. I'm not going to defend him, and I'm not going to praise him. He was the one who had the power and authority at that time to pass the sentence within the law as it was in this court on a number of occasions. And other courts throughout the country have said that where a prison sentence falls within the limits of a statute, it will not amend it or set it aside. Now, it's the type of penalty. In the Weems case, the man out in the Philippines, the public official was chained and a number of other cruel and harsh acts along with the prison sentence. The length of the prison sentence itself, and I read a number of cases, a long line of cases, which says that it is not cruel and harsh punishment. I admit that it is shocking. I will say that it is shocking. But I think that Judge Colombo had every right to pass that sentence upon him. In this case, the legislature has determined that there is present in marijuana certain harmful, to a degree, harmful properties, and pursuant to the public health and welfare, it is going to make it a crime to possess it. Now, the Michigan statute is so worded that it says all possession. And I think it was very ably described by a former member of this court in the People versus Harper case, when a judge said that you don't have to be a lawyer to understand that in this case, possession means everyone who has possession of it, regardless of his intent. I am not speaking about the Harper case for the classifications. We are not dealing with Johnny Harper here because this is possession. And the statutory maximum in this case is the same as the Uniform Narcotic Act that the state of Michigan and all other states adopted. 10 years is not abusive when you think that other states have the same penalty or even more harsher penalty. One state, I think it's Texas, has a like penalty. We do not have the classification argument here. And I will say this, that no law permits anyone to commit a criminal act. And I quote that. But just the same in this particular case, whoever the writer may be, when I started out on this, I read most of the literature that was submitted by the opposition. I read the literature that was presented before the free court panel. I read other literature. I went to the Narcotic Bureau, the police department, the FBI, and everyone else, and I read it till it came out of my ears. I can understand why there is certain differences of opinion. And among medical and scientific men, it's hard to rationalize that there is such an existence. But we have to accept it for what it is. And everything here, as far as our presentation concerned, is hearsay. I admit that. I took that replacement of the heart with a bottle out of literature that was passed over my desk. It's hearsay. We don't have the testimony in front of us to question the source of it. But so is everything that Kaplan says. And I read the critique of Kaplan by another scientist who didn't think very highly of him. And I suppose Kaplan could say the same thing of the man who wrote his critique. But just the same, those matters, I think, must be presented before the legislature. And to say that the inclusion of marijuana in the Narcotic Drug Acts as it is presently written in the state of Michigan is a violation of equal protection or the abuse of due process cannot be heard.
Say that again.
To say that the inclusion of marijuana in the Michigan Narcotic Drug Act, the illegitimate, the Act 335.153, the act proscribing the illegitimate trade in narcotics, is a violation of the equal protection of the laws or due process, should not be entertained. Because I think there is a rational basis for the inclusion of marijuana in our narcotic laws. It's not an invidious discrimination. And I think there is some basis for it, even in the exhibit that was presented by the defense. It says that there is a psychological dependence. One cigarette can last several hours. It says that...
Are you telling me, then, that heroin and marijuana have the same properties?
No, sir. Absolutely not. I am convinced about that and reading all of the scientific reports that they do not have the same properties.
Well, then, why is the classification necessary, as you say?
Because it is conducive to injury to the public health and welfare to different degrees. Heroin has a devastating effect on a human body. So does marijuana, but to a different degree, and maybe a lighter degree. That's true. But that is something that the legislative will have to determine. Whether or not this man who's floating around on a binge, you might say, or the man that's drunk who can't even control his limbs, or the person that's out because of a overdose of heroin, those are something for the lawmakers to decide. And I think at this particular moment, while we do not still have a definite understanding of whether marijuana is harmful, I think we have to leave it rest in the hands of the legislature. Does that answer your question, sir?
Well, you've spoken to it, yes.
I think that insofar as the control of heroin is concerned, there is no argument that it is a harmful drug. In fact, it's proscribed by the United States government. And to a certain extent,
Does that
I think...
prove anything, Mr. Fenelby?
Pardon?
Does that prove anything?
It doesn't prove anything in and of itself, but it does prove that we have the white cases, the black cases, and the gray cases. Heroin is on this end of the yardstick. Aspirin is on this end of the yardstick. And in the middle, we have this foggy, wavy sort of a substance which we can call marijuana and a number of the other histamines and the goofballs and things of that nature that the legislature has to sift.
Is aspirin in question in this?
No, it's not, but I'm trying to clarify my answer to the court of why I think that marijuana must be something that the legislature has to decide, whether it should be proscribed or not by this honorable judicial body. I was trying to make a comparison, an argument. I was not trying to be facetious, Your Honor. I just want to say that where we do not have a definite scientific basis stating that it is not harmful to the health of the entire people of the state of Michigan, then, of course, we do not have to bring it within the legislature. And I don't think the legislature of this state nor any of the other states or the government of the United States would prescribe it.
If we have two extremes here and then a gray area in the middle, doesn't that call for different classifications?
I think it does. I think it does. And I think that every state in the country is graduating to that particular state where they are now recognizing and they are classifying marijuana in a separate statute. The government has done so in its Control and Abuse of Act. I think this state might do so. But the inclusion, as I say, in the present act does not make it unconstitutional just because there isn't a section for marijuana itself. And I think that the statute, the penalty for it is wide enough. There's enough range in it to penalize anyone within that particular statute. Now, so far as I suggested in my brief that perhaps there's no room in a penitentiary for a marijuana violator, that's true. But maybe the good times statute, the special good times statute, should be individualized and particularized to various crimes. I've always stated that. Those statutes apply to everyone across the board, whether he's an armed robber or a murderer or a larcenist. I think that those good time statutes and special good time statutes should be particularized to various crimes. People can be rehabilitated sooner. And in this particular...
Yes,
sir.
Let me ask you a question.
The maximum for the offense of which Mr. Sinclair was convicted is what?
10 years.
And that maximum by statute must be applied by the judge in every sentence,
does
it not?
That's right, sir.
So the judge only sets the lower level.
That's true, sir.
He can make it 1 to 10, 5 to 10,
that's
9
right,
to 10,
that's
so
right,
on. Now, if he makes it 1 to 10, is there any assurance that the parole board and the corrections commission will not keep the defendant there for 10 years?
No assurance. They can flop him anytime they want.
So even though he might have been given a 1 to 10 sentence, if the Corrections Commission wanted to keep him there for 10 years, they could.
That's true, sir.
All right.
there's any other questions, I'd be glad to answer.
What is the situation on a 9.5 to 10? What can the Corrections Commission do there in terms of releasing him?
He would get the statutory good time and special good time, and that is all. I don't know what that is. I've never figured it.
7.5 years.
Somewhere around that, Your Honor. I could tell exactly. I know it's by statute.
Mr. Palladino, maybe you could address yourself to an issue raised by the defense in this matter, but not touched on very much by the counsel for the defense. And this issue that is of particular interest to me is entrapment. Seems that this defendant was charged under two counts. One, what we generally call sale, and the other, possession. And the first count was dismissed because of the quality of the evidence. The evidence being obtained, I believe the trial judge said, through entrapment. But then the same evidence was used, for the conviction on the second count, that of possession.
Yes, sir.
Well, what is your feeling on that? Is it's not good for one purpose? Why? How is it resurrected and made admissible and viable?
Well,
for the
as I understand purpose? The law to be, Your Honor, the entrapment does not go to the admissibility of the particular evidence into trial. It is not something that you can keep out on a collateral motion. It's something that you can bring into the course of the trial itself, so far as unlawful, perhaps search warrant, which may be set aside for some defect in the affidavit. But entrapment itself, the argument of entrapment, does not per se keep out a particular piece of evidence. In this particular case, possession. He had the possession of the marijuana before the entry of the police officers were there. There was no entrapment so far as possession is concerned. Now, to say that it is the fruits of an illegal activity.
But the only evidence introduced into the trial were these two cigarettes, were they not?
That's true. But they are governed by separate rules of trial and evidentiary rules. They are not covered by one and the same. And so far as the cigarettes here are concerned, they were in that apartment before the defendant and before the two officers entered at his invitation. The entrapment does not...
He made this, if I read the transcript right, he made the cigarettes for them and handed them to these two people.
That's true.
So they weren't in existence before. And this was the only evidence introduced into the trial.
That's true, sir.
You know, with the count one for providing, dispensing, administering, selling...
Possession and control. That's true. The sale count was booted by the trial judge.
But then the very same... And he booted... When you say booted...
He booted the sale count.
Yes,
he,
I realize.
He granted a motion to dismiss.
Dismiss.
Yes.
And what did he base that on?
I don't know. I personally think he gave him a break myself because the activities of the police officers...
What did he say he based it on?
I don't know.
And he said it was an entrapment, didn't he?
He said entrapment. But what he based the theory of entrapment on was just a surveillance of the officers. And the surveillance of the officers alone, per se, is never entrapment. They did not induce... This man was convicted twice before of marijuana. And he was a known person who indulged and trafficked in marijuana. How you can say you can entrap someone with that personal background? And I get this law from various authorities. It just doesn't hold. Now, in this particular case, we have...
Palladino, I think what Mr. Justice Swainson was addressing himself to was the nature of offense charged here.
Yes, sir.
And in the original charge was that he sold marijuana to these police officers.
That's true.
And the testimony was that he made two cigarettes for these police officers and handed them to them. And one of them was lighted, eventually butted, and the other was unlighted in his presence. I think the question that Mr. Justice Swainson is talking about is, under all of these circumstances, if the entrapment ruled out the charge of sale, we're not talking about the possession of the sugar bowl We're talking about the possession of the cigarettes.
That's true.
Why doesn't it knock out the cigarettes, too?
For the purposes of possession.
Because that crime pre-existed prior to the giving away of the cigarettes. There's no entrapmentness to that.
That hasn't been proven.
He had that
the sugar bowl with the substance that is alleged to have been the marijuana was never introduced into the trial, was it?
Never, no, sir.
Only the cigarettes?
Only cigarettes, and he had those in his hands.
It wasn't valid for count one, the sale, but somehow was resurrected for count two, the possession.
They were both charged at the same time, in the same information, both counts. One was not added when the
same evidence was introduced to establish both counts.
That's true, sir.
Well, that's the point of the question. How can it be good for one and not for the other?
Because, as I understand the law, the defense of entrapment does not go to the admission of that particular item into trial evidence, provided that the evidence was existing prior to the offense which was dismissed, like the sale count here. No one entrapped him to possess it. He had it all the time. If the defendants, if the police officers, induced by their surveillance and helping out around the workshop and worked themselves into the confidence of them.
Excuse me, Mr. Penalino, and there's no point to be served by discussing it too much longer, but the point is that he did not possess these cigarettes for any length of time. He made them for the purpose of passing them on to these people, these police officers.
I don't think the time limit...
Well, you're arguing that he possessed this for... his possession was anterior to his passing them on.
That's true. He may have possessed them for a second. No one knows. He may have possessed them for just a very short time, but he did have them in his possession.
Okay.
He must have had them in his possession to be able to make them and turn them over.
All right.
I think it's immature.
Mr. Penalino, the sale charge would carry a minimum prison sentence of 20 years, would it not?
Yes, sir.
Wouldn't that explain why the judge dropped the sale charge?
That's very true, sir. That's a horrendous sentence for anyone for marijuana.
Penalino, I'm interested. You say it was a horrendous sentence. 20 years.
Yes, sir. I've never liked that sentence.
Well, now, why is it horrendous? I mean, why are you shocked by that, and what impact might that have on what we were talking about a little while ago about classification? Suppose there had been heroin involved. Would it, in your mind, have been horrendous?
No. No.
So you make a classification.
That's true. I do. Personally, my own judgment, I don't think that possession of marijuana should be subject to the same penalty as possession of heroin. But that's my own personal opinion. I'm not the legislator. I am not...
All right, you don't have to go any further. You've made your point.
And I say that many trial judges are of the same opinion. That's true.
What do you think about the municipal statutes that have been passed?
I think they're very good. I think a lot of good come out of them. I think that's probably the projected course, maybe on this marijuana business. I think that maybe more study should go along on that. I'm not contrary to them at all.
Was there a conflicting municipal ordinance in the city of Detroit at the time of this transaction? If you know.
I don't know, Your Honor. I think the municipal ordinance of recent vintage.
If you don't know, don't make a speech about it.
I don't know. I think my brief covers all of my other arguments, yeah.
You have more time if you want.
No. But unless there are further questions.
Mr. Rabbit.
Thank you. I'd just like to speak quickly to some of the points, if I might. The palpable reason, it seems to me, why John Sinclair was not charged as a second or third offender, in fact, was based upon the fact that he was charged with sale. and that cell case was not dismissed until the eve of the first trial in June of 1968. And as we know, cell carries quite enough, a minimum mandatory 20. With respect to a question asked about other states' laws, I would point out to the court that Mr. Penalino is correct. Texas has a statute that carries 2 to life. I wonder if one would be happy with that statute. I wonder if one would find life an unconstitutional, cruel, and unusual punishment, and what a prosecutor would say about that. 5 other states have a maximum possession sentence, possible possession sentence, of up to 10 years. 43 other states have more lenient possession statutes, a goodly number making them misdemeanors. So the status of the comparative analysis among the states shows that behind Texas, Michigan and 5 other states run first for harshness and severity. Thirdly, on the question of entrapment, I understand the thrust of some of the questions that were directed to Mr. Penalino by your honors. I would point out that I did not dwell on that issue because I thought it was very well briefed. It seems to me that what is perfectly plain is that the unlawfully entrapped alleged cell gave rise to the discovery at the same time and the same place of the allegedly possessed marijuana. And therefore, if we apply People versus Hamilton, and therefore, if the Wong Sun Doctrine applies, and therefore, if the deterrent principle of entrapment, as well as the evidentiary principle of deterrence of the exclusionary rule, is to be made operative, then clearly, that evidence so discovered is inadmissible because it was come at by exploitation of the primary taint. Mr. Penalino made one statement that he certainly couldn't document and that I wish to point out to the court. John Sinclair is not known for trafficking in marijuana. And he said that, and the record does not support that. And I wish to point that out to the court. There is, Mr. Justice Brennan, still no municipal ordinance in the city of Detroit, even at this time.
Mr. Ravitz, may I ask you another question?
Certainly.
Let us assume, instead of a 9.5 to 10, Mr. Sinclair had received, say, 6 months to 10 years, or 1 to 10. Would you agree with Mr. Penalino's statement that the question of whether or not he serves the whole 10 years depends upon the judgment of the parole board?
It does, Your Honor.
And that judgment, would it not be made on the basis of their assessment of the progress of his rehabilitation?
That's correct.
Now, what do you do in these areas where somebody says, as a matter of principle, he does not believe in the law that he is alleged, that he is convicted of having violated? And in effect, he shows no remorse. He shows no attitude of changing his behavior. He's there to pay the penalty to be exacted by the law, whatever that may be. But in terms of this rehabilitative thrust of our law, he's not interested in being rehabilitated in the sense that he plans and intends to continue the course of conduct which he of which he was convicted.
Well, the simple answer, but it's applied to the facts of this case, is when he's right, you change the law. That's the simplest answer. Beyond that, there are a host of obvious problems, which I'm sure the court is aware of, in terms of the indeterminate sentence, or in terms of giving so much scope to the corrections standing of the separation of powers doctrine. It happens that there is an Eighth Amendment. It happens that the courts of this land owe principal allegiance, it's been mentioned ever since Marbury versus Madison, to the Constitution, and that the system of check and balance is for the judicial branch of government to counter, check, and control unconstitutional legislation. So one we know that, in fact, It is within the province, indeed the obligation of the judicial branch of government, to strike down unconstitutional legislation on its face or as applied. We know that much. And then we get to the question of, is it or is it not unconstitutional? Under the cruel and unusual doctrine, under the Weems test. But under all that we know, that we've enumerated to this court, yes, it is. It's disproportionate to the nature of the offense. Therefore, it's the duty of this court to apply the Eighth Amendment. And that is a system of separation of powers. With respect to the equal protection analysis, I direct Your Honor's attention to page 71 of our brief, which really parallels the Illinois decision. Certainly, it isn't up to the court to question the judgmental wisdom of debatable legislation. Certainly, the legislature, great deference is given to the legislature with respect to determine the evil as they see it necessary to apply the law and to go a step at a time as they see fit, etc. We concede all that as
immediate consideration of the rest
matters is the state of science
in full before it is considered.
Is not more harmful than marijuana. And the prosecutor wouldn't say that. Well, that makes the classification irrational under the Illinois scheme of that of equal protection.
Right,
okay, I'm going to conclude.